This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Dubbed the godfather of biodiversity, Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy was among the first scientists to coin the phrase biological diversity. A tropical and conservation biologist who has worked in the Brazilian Amazon since 1965, Dr. Lovejoy also works on the interface of science and environmental policy. He originated the concept of depth for nature swaps and has worked on the interaction between climate change and biodiversity for more than 20 years. He joins me now for a chat about his life and work. Welcome, Dr. Lovejoy. How are you today?
I am just fine, thank you. Looking forward to my visit.
Just to start off with, what sparked your interest in nature and what led you to become a biologist?
So although I'm told that as a little kid I was outdoors all the time and clearly found animals interesting, it was a fabulous biology teacher when I was 14 who just flipped my switch. And I literally said I'd take this biology course and get it over with, and here I am.
And as a tropical biologist and a conservation biologist, you worked in the Amazon jungles of Brazil since 1965, if I'm correct.
That's right.
So what first attracted you to go there? And, you know, why have you devoted so much of your life to studying its ecosystems?
Well, I mean, to start with, I was really looking to have scientific adventures. Mm-hmm. And I got a chance to go to the Amazon in June of 1965. And there was one highway in an area as big as the 48 continental U.S. states. And it was just filled with all kinds of fascinating plants and animals, so I never looked back.
And could you tell me a bit about that, you know, that remarkable diversity that you encountered during your early trip to the Amazon?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like tropical Asia, of course. You know, the tropics of the world are the most biologically diverse, and it translates into, you know, many hundreds of species of trees. You know, every time you look at something, it's different than what you were looking at before. Mm-hmm. So just the sheer variety of it is fascinating. But then the still unanswered questions is, you know, how can you actually have such biological richness coexisting? And it's probably a little bit about the length of time the tropics have had to evolve all kinds of different species. And a lot of things we still have yet to understand.
Yeah. And you've been going since 1965. How have the jungles changed over these last few decades? You know, was it already evident just how much habitat was already being lost in the Amazon?
So actually, when I first went there maybe was 2 or 3% of the Amazon was deforested. Mm-hmm. Now it's probably close to 20%. And in the case of the Amazon, since it makes half of its own rainfall, I think it's close to a threshold. Mm-hmm. That could lead to it drying out and going into dieback. And so, therefore, it's really important to do some serious reforestation. And happily, the Brazilian government understands the need to do that and to build back a margin of safety.
Were there animals or plants that you used to see but haven't seen or heard in a long while?
Well, not particularly where I've been working, because I've been working in close to continuous forest. Mm-hmm. But certainly in some of the southeastern parts of the Amazon, there's some species which have become quite rare.
Okay. And you conceived the idea for the long-term study on forest fragmentation in the Amazon, which started in 1978. It's also known as the Biological Dynamics of Forest Fragments Project, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. That's its long technical name, but I just call it the Forest Fragments Project.
Forest Fragments Project. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit more about this study?
Well, you know, in the beginning of the 1970s, suddenly the question arose as to whether habitat fragmentation was actually a serious conservation issue. Mm-hmm. And previously it hadn't been considered that because you don't see all the consequences quickly. They spread over time.
Yes, of course.
And there are certain sort of theories about the numbers of species of islands that made people to question whether maybe this didn't also apply to islands of vegetation. Mm-hmm. And I was working for the World Wildlife Fund, and I realized that almost none of our projects would succeed unless we really understood how this works.
So now, do you have a good understanding about, you know, what should be done with those fragments that are left behind, and, you know, about how you can reconstitute the forest there?
So there's general reforestation, of course, but one of the critical lessons that comes out of all of this is to put as much natural connection back into landscapes as possible.
What do you mean by natural connections, please?
Just, you know, restoring forest corridors between, you know, fragments of habitat, connecting fragments to larger expanses of wilderness by doing reforestation, things like that.
Okay. And is it the longest running experiment in tropical forests? Did you kind of get the answers you expected?
Yes, so we got some surprises too, but I think the single most important result is that a 100-hectare fragment loses half of the bird species of the forest interior in less than 15 years. And those are the species of birds that don't like to come out into sunlight. For them, the shade of the forest is their environmental cue.
Okay.
And so you lose half of those in less than 15 years. So that means fragmentation is a really serious problem. And that one should think not only about, you know, protecting large areas of rainforest like it's just been done in northern Sabah, but also in the end that conservation is not just about conservation, it's also about protection and connection.
And back in 1980, you wrote that hundreds of thousands of species will perish, and this reduction of 10 to 20% of the Earth's biota will occur in about half a human lifespan. And this reduction of the biological diversity of the planet is the most basic issue of our time. What sort of led you to this prediction?
So I was asked, it was actually wasn't a prediction, it was a projection.
Okay.
A really important distinction, because you do a projection in the hopes that, in fact, there will be a response to it and
yes, of course,
and that the bad things won't happen.
Yeah.
So having said that, nonetheless, I mean, if you look at what's happening to the rapid rate of destruction of natural habitats in the world and climate change now coming down on top of all of that, we are clearly at the beginning of the sixth major extinction of life on Earth, unless we turn things around.
You know, you're not the only scientist. I mean, a lot of scientists are saying they were experiencing this extinction crisis. And, you know, they claim that this starting about 10,000 years ago, you know, particularly the past two centuries, it's just wildlife is going extinct at unnatural high rates. Do you think this also coincides with human agriculture and expansion across Earth? You know, what's your take on the extinction crisis and you know, our roles in it?
Yeah, so it is clearly human-driven. And it's because of conversion of natural habitats for agriculture, for human settlement. You know, I mean, it's just going on at an extremely rapid rate. And it's not surprising that suddenly the number of endangered species and the extinction rate itself is going up to maybe 1,000 times normal.
You know, but scientists have also estimated that close to 99% of all life, you know, that ever existed on Earth is now extinct. So wouldn't extinction then be a sort of like a common motif in the fabric of nature? You know, why should we bother? It's not the human race that's going extinct.
So first of all, the natural support of human societies is really important. So it's not like we could just sit there and let it all go extinct and think we'll be just fine, because that's not true. But the larger point here is that this is the first time in the history of life on Earth that one species has caused or is starting to cause a major extinction spasm.
Yeah.
So it's completely up to us whether we keep doing that or we embrace the rest of the natural world as important for us and important in itself.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy. He's a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation and a university professor in the Environmental Science and Policy Department at George Mason University. Dr. Lovejoy was also one of the first scientists to have coined the term biological diversity over 30 years ago. And we find out how that came about after this break. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the phone today is Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy. He's one of the world's foremost conservation biologists who has made the fate of tropical forests a public issue, and we're discussing, among many other things, how to better protect our global ecosystems. Also in the 1980s, you helped coin the term biological diversity. Could you just share the story of how that happened?
Well, you know, the really interesting story about that is people were talking about species diversity, and even my PhD thesis looked at that in terms of birds and trees in the Amazon. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a big leap to go to biological diversity just to describe the variety of life on Earth. And there were three of us who actually used it in 1980, and none of us were thinking, oh, we're creating a new term, you know, or who was first. And it was only some years later that one of the three of us went back and looked and said, I think you were the first.
It's like, who was the first man on the moon?
Yeah.
Were biologists just not thinking along those terms at the time, you think?
Well, yeah, if you look back, I mean, starting back probably in the 40s or something like that, people working in ecological science got interested in numbers of species and mm-hmm. what tended to set the number of species. And then along came the theory of island biogeography about, you know, what sets the number of species you find on an island. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a huge leap from there to think about biological diversity as a whole. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time talking with Ed Wilson about it, who was one of the three of us, and we talked all around it because we didn't have the term for the variety of life on Earth. So once the term emerged, it just sort of took off.
And, you know, just to us non-biologists who probably don't understand it, how would it matter whether an ecosystem is diverse with many different species or simple with just a few?
So the simpler the ecosystem is, mm-hmm. The more likely it is to big swings in performance of services, whether it's of watershed services or it's sequestering carbon, or in the end, the incredibly important role of nurturing the variety of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Any species of which can turn out, you know, in a moment, to turn out to be hugely beneficial to human society. These are just a whole bunch of unread books sitting in a library mm-hmm. That once we know more about them can do all kinds of wondrous things for us.
And just looking at food, you know, recalling the pyramid-like structure of the food web, for example, there are fewer predator species at the top compared, you know, with the rest of the web. Would that mean that predators are more important or less important to the integrity of the web?
Well, as it turns out, if you remove predators from ecosystems, you get all kinds of changes that spread through those ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And the ecosystems tend to become simpler. Mm-hmm. And if you restore a predator, like restoring wolves back in Yellowstone, all of a sudden the ecosystem begins to restore back towards its original structure, even at the level of vegetation along banks of streams.
Mm-hmm. And with so many species, you know, in a food web and with so many linkages between them, could you just describe how plucking one, you know, any one species away would affect that web?
So sometimes you can take a species out of a food web and it won't seem to change very much. Another time you will take one out and a whole bunch of things will disappear.
Yeah.
So, for example, remove army ants from a forest in the Amazon, mm-hmm. and there will be at least 12 bird species that will drop out, mm-hmm. and about 110 butterfly species, which follow the birds, which follow the ants. Mm-hmm. And there are probably a whole bunch of other changes that will occur as well.
Because they also, you know, help with seed dispersal and things like that, if I'm not wrong.
Seed dispersal, disease control, yeah. All kinds of things like that.
Do you feel that people now understand the concept of biodiversity enough, you know, that it's actually informing policy that sort of better protects global ecosystems?
Well, we certainly have made some progress. I mean, we do have a convention on biological diversity at the international level, and most countries have biodiversity science and conservation policies. But we're pressing up against, you know, increasing numbers of human beings and an inefficient agricultural system. Mm-hmm. So we actually need to do a much better job of reconciling all of that.
You know, you've served in an official capacity in the Reagan, George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations. So perhaps you're better placed than most to comment on how governments tackle the environment. You know, was it possible to get sustainable development accepted across government?
So, you know, it's taken a bit of time to get it going, but, you know, sustainability is something you hear all over the place these days. So the Inter-American Development Bank, for example, puts sustainability as its number one priority.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that, you know, there's an opening from government authorities to listen to what science has to say? Are they taking science seriously?
So, I see variation, of course. You know, I've seen at least one administration which really didn't want to listen to what science had to say. But generally speaking, I find, especially if you can just explain it in simple language, that people will respond.
Any success story that you could share?
Well, you know, I'm in a funny kind of way. Having started the Forest Fragments Project in the Amazon, which was all directed towards a single question of how large should a national park be?
Yes.
Even before we began to get answers, the Brazilian government, when it created protected areas in the Amazon, made them very large.
Mm-hmm. You also originated the concept of debt for nature swaps. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
So the idea of debt for nature is it's actually just a financial mechanism, mm-hmm. Which one uses to fund various conservation and environmental projects. And it got started because I was listening to a hearing criticizing the effects of debt on social systems and then environmental systems in countries, as countries just took measures to get the resources to pay off the debt. And then I suddenly wondered, well, I wonder if you couldn't turn that around.
Mm-hmm.
And so the core of the idea is that international debt, whether it's privately held debt or governmental debt, is essentially forgiven in exchange for the same amount of money in national currencies spent in the country on something that's of conservation benefit.
Okay, and did it take off? Did many countries adopt this?
Yes, many, many countries have done it, many more than I can even list these days because it's no longer considered news.
Okay.
Literally billions and billions of dollars have been done that way.
Okay. And you've also worked on the interaction between climate change and biodiversity for more than 20 years now. And I was reading an opinion piece that you wrote in the New York Times where you said, you know, it's abundantly clear that the target of a 2 degrees Celsius limit to climate change was mostly derived from what seemed convenient and doable without any reference to what it really means environmentally. Could you tell me what you meant by that?
Yeah, so having looked at this subject since like about 1985, mm-hmm. there's nowhere on Earth you don't see the fingerprints of climate change in nature.
Yeah.
And we're also already seeing some major abrupt changes like coral bleaching events and coral reefs.
Exactly.
Dieback and the coniferous forests in Western North America because the pine beetle now is favored by the changing climate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, at less than a degree. And another really important point, and certainly for a country with as much coastline as Malaysia, is that the last time the planet was 2 degrees warmer, the oceans were 4 to 6 meters higher.
Right.
So I don't think you need to know a lot more than that to know that 2 degrees is actually not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And happily, if there is a lot of ecosystem restoration of degraded and destroyed habitats around the world, there's a chunk of that carbon dioxide that can come back out of the atmosphere into living ecosystems before it causes that climate change.
So, you know, what are your proposals to sort of change this? I mean, you just mentioned restoring ecosystems, but, you know, you mentioned geoengineering schemes probably aren't the best idea. Could you sort of elaborate on that?
Well, most geoengineering schemes are schemes at the level of the entire planet, so mm-hmm. like throwing particles up in the atmosphere to reflect sunlight back into space. And when you cease doing that, for whatever reason, the climate will go back to exactly where it would have been had you never been doing that at all.
Right.
So it's not dealing with the cause, it's dealing with the symptom. And when you do that, you do absolutely nothing for the acidification of the oceans, which is one of the other consequences of high CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So most of them, I think, are a desperate, ill-advised kind of way to go at it. Or as the U.S. National Academy of Sciences said, you can't actually engineer a system that you don't understand. So I think it really behooves ourselves to deal with the energy sources that are throwing all the CO2 in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and also literally recognizing that our planet works as a living and physical system linked together. And that if we manage it that way, we can actually eliminate sources of CO2 from deforestation. We can pull CO2 back out of the atmosphere by restoring coastal wetlands and reforesting, and also just simply planting trees.
Yeah.
And if we do that, suddenly we've changed the public understanding of this planet on which we live.
What were your thoughts on the resolution or the outcome of COP21 and the Paris Agreement?
So I was really encouraged by the outcome mm-hmm. of COP21. All the countries voluntarily coming with measures that they were willing to undertake.
Yeah.
Now, is it enough? No, but it's a huge first step. And so I'm really thrilled that it got going like that. And now we just have to keep on figuring out how we can do even more.
And also, you know, to make sure that people keep to their promises. I suppose that's the most important thing as well.
Always good to keep to your promises.
just before we end, how do you think things will look in, you know, just two or three generations ahead? Are you optimistic that we can avoid some of the greatest intergenerational environmental injustice of our time?
Well, I really think it is the environmental injustice issue of all time because of its impact for future generations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're quite capable of serious change, you know, once it's widely recognized as desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's every reason to be optimistic in the sense of thinking, how can we do something about this,
yep.
as opposed to being optimistic and saying, oh, it'll all just come out fine.
And what would your advice be to the man on the street? Just one little thing that they can change, you know, to help.
So, you know, all of us are part of the energy cycle.
Mm-hmm.
All of us can do better in terms of the energy we consume and the kinds of energy we consume.
Yep.
And also what we can do with our own little plot of land to sequester carbon by growing trees.
Okay, lovely. Thank you so much, Dr. Lovejoy.
Thank you.
That was tropical and conservation biologist Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy discussing how we can all better protect our global ecosystems from further destruction. You've been listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.